Welcome, Red Eyes members. Thank you very much for tuning in. It's nice to have you with us. We are talking to Lon Milo Duquette, and we have primarily been discussing Aleister Crowley, but also a little bit about the some of the Western magical traditions, Rudolf Steiner, and hearing some of the interesting anecdotes, and I guess in one term, kind of clarified a few of the misconceptions, I guess, about Crowley, about what he was talking about, what he was writing about, and his veiled terminology, if you will. And it's always interesting to hear from other perspectives and sources about this, because this has been so much tossed back and forth. Again, as Lon mentioned in the first segment, that the conception that he's a Satanist, and there's so much more information that says otherwise, and it's very interesting to hear him about that. And another aspect of this that we didn't really talk about is the idea of Thelema, or the philosophy, I guess, of Thelema as well. And if there's time later on in this second segment, we might go into that too and talk a little bit about that. But I want to talk here at the beginning of this segment, Lon, a little bit about your book, Enochian Vision Magic. And we don't have time to address it all, of course, but maybe you can just give us a little bit of background around the idea of Enochian magic. And maybe you can begin by telling us why you've been drawn in by this. This is, of course, a system that was developed by John Dee and Edward Kelly, if I'm not mistaken. And was this something that you encountered pretty early on as well in your research and studies, Lon?
Well, yes, it was. Back in 1975, I got chartered a lodge of OTO here in Southern California. And it was part of my perceived duties as a lodge master to provide a Monday night or to provide a weekly magic class. That class is still going on. So it's sort of dominated my life. After the first years or so, or approaching a year, I was starting to run out of things to teach these people. If I was going to teach them something, I was going to have to learn something new. So in a desperate attempt to keep 1 week ahead of my pupils, I thumbed through my gems of the equinox and came across the Enochian material that Crowley had originally published in the Equinox series. And it was, it seemed like an exotic, very, very attractive, system of magic that looked pretty complex. And, I pulled out my Golden Dawn book material and I read up on the, how the Golden Dawn utilized Enochian magic. And so between how the Golden Dawn used it and how Crowley used it, it became pretty clear that this would be something that my class would benefit from. Mm-hmm. And basically, the Enochian magic that was performed by the Golden Dawn and the way it was used by Crowley utilizes material that John Dee and Edward Kelly received through their magical angelic contacts, but is material they received only in the last 90 days of their nearly 3 years of angelic magical operations. And that prior to that last 90 days, they received, let's say, 2.5 separate magical systems, or so it appeared. Part of those magical systems were the creation of magical furniture that in their own way seemed like it was a working model of creation that was actually with several moving parts. Okay. And Crowley and the Golden Dawn, you know, published the pictures of this furniture, the Holy Table, the Sigillum de Amethe, the Seven Ensigns of Creation. But they didn't do anything with them. They didn't attempt to make them part of their use of the Enochian system. They just sort of published them to, I guess, to tantalize you and me. And so I've been performing and practicing Enochian magic like the Golden Dawn did it, like Crowley did it. Just right out of the Golden Dawn Crowley box, it works wonderfully. If you do X, Y, and Z, visions do appear. And if you do things in a very structured and organized way, and you keep good notes, Enochian magic is practiced by the Golden Dawn, and Crowley is a wonderful weapon in a modern magician's arsenal. So Dr. Christopher Hyatt and I, way back in the 90s, early 90s, wrote kind of an extended commentary just explaining Crowley and Golden Dawn Enochian magic in such a way as you can read the book in one day and do Enochian magic that night. And that's still in print. It's called Enochian, the Enochian World of Aleister Crowley, with the subtitle Enochian Sex Magic, the titillating subtitle.
Right, right. Lond, let's say for someone who don't know anything at all about this system, or what the purpose is, or for what reason why one would like to dive into it. Tell us a little bit more about it from the perspective if we're just coming into the subject, if you will.
Thank you for bringing me back to reality.
No problem.
There are two branches of Enochian magic right out of the box. One branch deals with the elemental universe, our manifest universe, matter and energy as we know it, we can imagine all of the energy and matter in the universe as being a wonderfully organized system, and that within that organization are big forces like gravity and electromagnetism and the strong force, the weak force, and then there's smaller aspects of those great forces. And we could look at the big forces as if they were angels, because they actually do have control over how the universe operates. And the little forces, little applications of those giant forces that actually do the busy work, to do the dirty work of the universe, we could look at those as being angels working under the auspices of their big archangels. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure.
It'd be like gravity is an archangel, but the concept of falling, the concept of slipping, the concept of drooping are angels that work within that that archangel's authority.
So would you say that it's still, one can still, if you know what I mean, still make a kind of a scientific interpretation, but this is another terminology to explain some of the forces and physical laws, if you will, of the universe that we're in.
Precisely.
Gotcha.
So part of the Enochian magic system is it deals with these four elements, four great elements of the that hold everything in the universe or make up everything in the universe together. And so the, you and me are made up of these elements too, not only our physical bodies, but our psychic structure. You know, we could attribute the element of fire to, you know, a lightning bolt or the radiant sun, but we could also attribute fire to our, losing our temper or the nature of Tabasco sauce.
Right.
Okay. And, so it not only deals with material things, it deals with energy and concepts too. And Enochian magic allows us to treat these abstract concepts as if they were literal angels with a hierarchy above them and a hierarchy below them. And it gives us the opportunity to take these inner qualities. Just like we mentioned in the first minutes of our talk here, take these inner concepts and deal with them as if they were outer concepts. Mm. And the beauty of Enochian magic is that the result of your invocation, or if you will, the bringing forth, the evocation of these abstract principles, they take the form of visions that you have in your mind. Mm. And the visions, the process of having these visions is called scrying, S-K-R-Y-I-N-G or S-C-R-Y-I-N-G. And it's also called traveling in the spirit vision. So what you do is the process of Enochian magic is to systematically, through the techniques, open up very, very narrow and specific quadrants of the universe. And seeing how they function in the metaphors of images of angels and images of sometimes they take the form of even stories. In a way, it's kind of hard to explain and very easy to do and experience.
Hmm.
I'll give an example. For elemental magic, you go into a very specific subdivision of air. You know, air, water, fire, and earth, in a way we think of them as pure concepts, but they all contain within themselves, portions of other elements.
Yes.
If they didn't have portions of other elements, there wouldn't be an attractor within the main element that would cause it to bond with other elements. It sort of needs bait. Water needs air bait to attract air.
Right.
Okay. And So it all seems so very cold and abstract. But when you think of it in terms of visions, it becomes marvelously attractive and romantic. Let's say you want to explore a specific level of water, of the element of water, but the one that contains within it large particles of air. And so instead of thinking of it in scientific terms, all of a sudden you have a vision of the bubbles in Perrier water.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And the beauty of the vision is that those bubbles are living things that you can talk to and who answer back. And once you start working with the system, you find yourself very comfortable in every conceivable mix and match environment that you can imagine. And in doing so, and you think that, well, that's fine and good and very entertaining, but what does it do to you?
Right.
What it does to you and what you should be focused on it doing to you is it reprograms you. It reprograms you. It rebalances you. Okay. Before I do this series of elemental and sub-elemental magical workings, I don't have a clue about how I fit in to this elemental world. I don't have a clue. I am just lumbering through the elemental universe, blind, deaf, and dumb. But the experience of actually being in that environment, the experience itself, the vision itself, reprograms you. You come out of every one of these sessions a more balanced individual on many levels. And it's something you just can't, or you very, very seldom feel it happening to you. You were so close to yourself that you don't feel yourself grow. You know, that's why spiritually you always go, oh, I'm not getting anywhere, until you think about where you were a year ago.
Right. See what you mean?
Yeah. So there's many ways that you can apply this, and it's not limited to people that perform ceremonial magic, as we like to think of it, with wands and cups and swords and discs. This is very, very universal process that you can take on all sorts of levels, and it's very attractive, especially for artists and musicians. To gain this greater depth of perception of how the universe and operates, and your particular place in the universe. So that's the elemental side of Enochian magic, and there's what's called the etheric side of Enochian magic, and this is the one that fascinates me the most at this period in my life. Because working with the Enochian aethers or the Enochian heavens is a parallel process, very similar to what the Kabbalists call path workings. Hmm. And for those that aren't familiar with that process, the Kabbalists have this marvelous schema called the Tree of Life. And there's 10 major landmarks in the Tree of Life, and the highest landmark is the equivalent of the environment of the consciousness of Supreme Deity, and the lowest one is right down here on Earth, you know, the most right. Earthy, in your face level of consciousness.
Yes.
And there are certain paths that connect these emanations, these 10 emanations, and there are certain images and colors and sounds that are at least by tradition sacred to these different levels. And you set to work by magical means, meditation and such, to visit these paths, and you have a vision in these paths that help you get to the next level. And that's called path working in Kabbalistic magic. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, most, in the nomenclature of most Western initiatory orders. The Enochian system does exactly the same thing, or the etheric part of the Enochian system. Only instead of 10 major landmarks, there are 30. Hmm. 30 levels of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're still dealing with the same universe. We're still dealing with the big supreme consciousness of the universe of which we are a part. Actually, we are the supreme consciousness of the universe. We just haven't woken up to that fact.
Mm-hmm.
And each step in path working and each step in the Enochian Aether work is our gradual step-by-step waking up and raising our own consciousness. And it's still the same universe. We're just looking at it with the Kabbalah. We're looking at it through a pair of eyeglasses that break things up into tens. And with Enochian visions, we're wearing a pair of eyeglasses that break the same absolute supreme consciousness with eyeglasses that break things up into 30. Does that make sense?
Right. And if we talk about the Enochian, the first one that you mentioned, in regards to the elements and so forth, on one hand, one can see that this is to better understand the different levels or even the elements, to get familiar with the forces and the energies of the universe, to study it or to learn from it, of course, and in that way grow, because that makes that helps you to understand yourself, basically. But also what I wanted to ask you, have you noticed or do you think that there are people also that are at the same time in one way or another trying to influence, or even, if you want to use that term, control these forces or energies?
Yes. Well, first of all, it goes to the motivation of the particular magician.
Yes.
I can't act as a moral judge on any other. I can try, but I shouldn't.
No.
But
have you tried it then?
Enochian magic to affect change in anything other than myself, I have not.
Right.
I do perform from time to time when my back's against the wall and I think it's totally appropriate to do so. I do perform Goetic evocation to do things like that, because I think that particular strata of consciousness is what does the heavy lifting in the universe. And when I need heavy lifting done, I don't hesitate to evoke those quote unquote spirits.
And is that you mentioned the Goetic invocation? Is that something called the Lesser Keys of Solomon? Is that the reference work here?
That's my favorite. That's my evocation drug of choice.
Okay, I see what you mean. All right, got you. And this other level, the etheric level that you talked about, the 30 levels of consciousness, is that more of going into, if you will, than the internal world of how we also are constructed in opposite to the other level, which seems to deal with more of the forces, of the external forces in the universe. Have I understand that correct, or am I missing the point?
Yes. And there is nothing to prevent an individual magician to exploring the possibilities of using the Enochian intelligences to do heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm. I've just
found for my personal workings and for the way I teach that the Enochians find it rather amusing when you try to use them for heavy lifting jobs.
They won't go along with it, huh?
Well, it's not that they won't go along to it. They don't resonate with the concept that's their job.
Right.
When you scry an Enochian aether, or when you call forth individual elemental spirits. What you're doing is getting a super intense a glimpse at the way things are, and in a way that you've never ever thought about it before. Mm. These are just marvelous opportunities for you to see the divine way things are, and it for you to cause change to occur on the material plane by means of these visionary experiences is certainly something you do, but it's your experience of seeing things the way they are causes you to grow as a magician so that you affect those changes in the world.
Yes. Well, I get your point, because I think you have a very good and simple in that regard a quote on your website that says, I can change only one thing with magic, myself. And in that sense, then to me, it means that also that if you change yourself, you actually, in one regard, are changing the world, or you're changing your perception of how you view the world. That's how I see it.
Right. You're changing the world in the only truly effective way that you can.
Right, right.
And, you know, people from time to time ask me, they say they're kind of frustrated with their ability to help mankind, and frustrated with their inability to better help mankind and to you know, affect good positive changes in the world around them. Mm-hmm. Almost like I would like to be a nice political magician, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that, and I certainly have my political points of view and bias, but I have to tell them that the greatest thing that you can do for the world is to gain enlightenment yourself.
Yes.
And until you gain enlightenment, you really don't have a clue as to what is in your best interest or not, or what's in the world's best interest or not. As long as you're just a well-meaning, unenlightened person, you may as well be a mean-spirited, nasty, unenlightened person, because you really don't know. You don't know what the score is.
That's
until
right.
You're enlightened yourself. Yeah.
That's right. And these have all these techniques or ways of going about studying yourself, basically. You feel that these have really helped you, and do you also feel that at how should I put it, that an already system that is already is set in place, so to speak, have that been the best way for you to go about it? Because in one regard, I also feel that it's very, very, very interesting with all these systems and all these set down rules and all this stuff in that sense. But I also feel this idea that one can also self-explore these areas, meaning that you can discover them yourself without the set of a system. I don't know if you would agree with that or not, but...
Oh, no, I absolutely agree. These systems, and everybody's going to hate me for this, but these systems, both Kabbalistic and Enochian, are truly just devices to open the way for you doing this kind of stuff completely on your own.
Right.
In the final analysis, you do everything alone. Even when you join great occult organizations and initiatory societies, and you do group rituals with people and all of that, well, it's fine and good. But all your magic, mm-hmm. all of it, you do yourself, and no two magicians do any of this stuff in the same way. Even while they're wallowing in the same system, they're each doing them dramatically different.
Mm. Would you, if we go into that a little bit in regards to magical orders and secret societies and so forth. Do you feel that there's a difference between a magical order and, let's say, a fraternal order? I don't know if you make that distinction, but it sounds a little bit to me with the terminology sometimes that you use that there is a quite a big difference between these two. Is that the case?
Well, there's big differences between different organizations. We'll just back way up and say there's that.
Mm-hmm.
There are magical organizations that are fraternal orders also.
Right.
It's a magical organization within the structure of a fraternal order. In Crowley's Thelemic magic, it'd be like the difference between the OTO, which is a fraternal organization, but it is also a magical order.
Hmm.
And then there's Crowley's AA, which is not a fraternal organization, but it is a magical order. And the
AA, that's the Astronom Argentum, or what is that? What's the?
Well, the AA is the AA, many people believe it's Latin for the Silver Star.
Silver Star, yeah, that's right. Okay,
right, and that may or may not be the case. It depends on who you who you're asking. You know?
Okay.
I'm going to give you a real example. I'm a Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. I don't rule the world. I'm not responsible for NATO. I'm just a Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't believe in a big Masonic conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a Freemason, and he was one of the most noble individuals that I've ever met. I believe that a great deal of his character was molded by his participation in Masonry. I really admired him, and before he died, he really wanted me to join the Masons too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he died before I did. And as a matter of fact, I waited till I was 50 years old to join the Masons. And when I did, I had already put over 25 years of experience in other truly magical organizations, overtly magical organizations, the ones that wear a little name tag that says, "Hi, I'm in a magical organization."
Yeah.
The Masons certainly wouldn't call itself a magical organization.
Sure, sure.
But I tell you, when I stood there at the door to be received in my entered apprentice degree, and I knocked on that door and I heard what they said in there, and the door was open and they took me in there, and they did this wonderful ceremony that hasn't changed very much in hundreds of years. I tell you, it was one of the biggest magical experiences of my life. And it was initiation of the highest degree. And it didn't matter that the old gentlemen who were my initiatory officers didn't have a real clue as to what they were doing.
Hmm.
And it didn't matter that they didn't know about magic or the rites of Eleusis, or they didn't know about all of the wonderful imagery and concepts of magic. It didn't matter. They were doing great magic, and they were doing great magic on me. And my mind was totally blown. And now there's a fraternal society that's a magical society that doesn't know it's a magical society. Mm. So you've
Well, that's interesting, because that was kind of one of my questions there. Do you think that because of your previous background with working with other orders and magical systems and your knowledge, that that actually helped to bring that about? But that's what, I guess, what you're saying here as well, then, that and would you also include in that you're kind of implying that many other people that are doing the rituals actually don't know what they're doing, in one sense?
Yeah. But in a very important sense, they whether they consciously grasp the what they're doing or not, they're doing it. And the advantages of a fraternal organization that prides itself on performing these beautiful initiation ceremonies in precisely the same way, with not a word changed in hundreds of years, is almost the equivalent. It was as if these old men held the secret of initiation and the secret of life, and they didn't learn it themselves, at least consciously. So, but the mere fact... Oh, go ahead.
So would you say then that their purpose for having this knowledge is only to actually pass them down to those who actually know what it means? Or do you still think that they, the ones who perform the rituals and the initiations, that they also are changed themselves? Because if they don't understand what they're doing, what are they really learning from it, if you know what I mean?
It's not perhaps what they're learning, but what they're becoming. And as that's why I mentioned at the very first, my father was a very unmystical kind of guy, but he was one of the most noble people I've ever met. His character was pure gold. And I believe that his exposure, and participation and his programming, how Masonry programmed him, whether he consciously knew it or not, it made him a better soul. It made him a better human being, and a better citizen, and a better father, and everything else. So it is a true initiation is such a pure energy that even those who come near it, who come approach the rays of you know, get benefit from it. And for those that actually know what they're looking for, it's a breathtaking experience. And I have since come in contact with other Masonic brothers that feel this way too. And there is there's a wonderful sort of below the radar esoteric Masonic movement, you know, all over the world. And in those cases, Masonry becomes a secret or a magical order that knows it's a magical order.
And I've heard this before, and there's some people who argue that also that we're and I'd like to get your take on this, that we're in a time, you know, in that sense right now, where the era of secrets are over, that many of these esoteric truths and lessons and systems and so forth are supposed to be like maybe not handed out to everybody in that sense, but in one sense, those who go and look for them can very easily find them today without, let's say, joining a fraternal order or something like that. Do you think that that's good or bad, or do you still think that they should be kept very much secret?
Oh, personally, I think the years of or the age of the necessity of keeping this all secret has long passed. You can Google your way into the secrets of the universe.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, you know, I continue to do so. I'm blown away. So absolutely, the secrecy, you know, and there's power in secrecy. But I think the age of the appropriateness of keeping things secret has passed. Usually the reason that things have been kept secret wasn't because they were so dangerous to humanity. It was because the political climate of the day was such that anybody engaging in spiritual practices that did not conform with powerful religious institutions could find you on the stake. And there hasn't been a heretic burned at the stake, you know, officially, you know, since the late 1700s. And so I really think that the reason for keeping the information secret is has long since passed. I'll give you the example of the OTO, because that's what I'm most experienced with. Mm-hmm. The magic of the OTO, you know, with each new degree, you're not given more information or a new knowledge lecture of material for you to master. The initiations are dramatic rituals designed to open you up to your own self-discovery of what the order considers a central and sacred secret. And any question that an OTO member should ask of a knowledgeable and advanced member of the OTO, any question that you can come up with, you'll get the answer. Okay. The only question that you won't get an answer for is, can you tell me the secret handshake of the third degree? Mm-hmm. And there you go. 'Cause that's just, that has to do with, the signs of recognition of your degree. That's just to stop imposters, you know, from presenting themselves as something they're not.
But does, so the re- sorry to cut you off, but does that still work then, considering some of the Masonic encyclopedias, if you will, that are out there and available today?
Yeah. Well, what works is that I can tell you to go to Duncan's Ritual for the Masons, or I can tell you to Google such and such a page, mm-hmm. and let you find it yourself. I just can't tell you.
Right.
So the thing is that you know, hopefully they won't waterboard me to get the secret handshake out of me. And even if I told you the secret handshake, what the hell does that mean anyway? The thing is that I have pledged, I have made a magical oath that I'm going to keep this particular thing sacred. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the discipline of a fraternal organization, for you to have that perpetual background meditation of I'm going to keep this thing sacred to anybody except a person that's gone through the same experience as I have. Mm.
And I'm also thinking about, well, I guess the reasons to keep these things secret in term of that, would you say that the primary enemy to Masonry and Freemasonry have been the established church, or who has been the most the prominent enemy here then, if you will?
The prominent enemy is ignorance. Hmm. And as the years roll by, the people that are competing for the greatest manifestation of ignorance is the greatest enemy. Mm-hmm. And there's at least in my opinion, there has been great stretches of time where the Catholic Church has been the champion of ignorance. And but personally, I think it goes back to the whoever it was that wrote under the name of Paul, as far as I really think Paul hijacked what might have been a wonderful spiritual movement.
Interesting.
But that's just my own.
Right, right.
I'm a small and bitter man.
Right. How about the relationship, I guess, then in terms of with Christianity still in that sense? If we talk about the OTO, for instance, they have something called EGC or the Gnostic Catholic Church. Is there any kind of relationship there to what is being taught, a different version of Christianity? Because again, I think in Freemasonic lore and so forth, there is a lot of relationship as I see it with Christianity, or do you think that that's wrong of me to perceive that?
Oh no, the way Masonry is developed in Europe and the United States, it has mostly been carried forward by people who are professing Christians, and there are certain Masonic rites where you have to say that you're a Christian to get into. But the overriding, I believe, like in Sweden and Norway, you have to be a
Christian.
Or you have to profess to be a Christian. And but in other parts of the world, they just require you to have a belief in a supreme being. But nonetheless, my brothers in my lodge, locally here, would consider themselves Christian or Jews. My lodge is probably a third Jewish also. That's just sort of been the effect of the cultures that Masonry has flourished in, rather than the demands, the traditional demands of the craft itself. In the 1700s in London, when the Masonry, officially started, it was probably inconceivable for any man of full age and of good report not to, in one way or another, at least considered themselves nominally a Christian. They just thought, well, a normal human being, a normal man of my age in England already is, and they didn't give it much thought that they might be letting a Buddhist or a Muslim or something in. But there was nothing in the craft per se that would prescribe a non-Christian. It just was, nobody ever thought there'd be a possibility of that.
But that's changed today, is it? Today you only have to believe in a supreme being, right?
Yes, and not only that, they're very accommodating. I'm a Thelemite, and my holy book is the Book of the Law. And when I joined the Masons, they opened and closed the lodge with the Book of the Law, and that's where I took my obligations on the Book of the Law.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. And I got a picture of it right up here in my office.
There you go. Okay. Would you say, Lon, that from your point of view, that enlightenment only can be reached through initiatory societies? Or do you think that that's you can?
Oh, no. I think that's an absurd statement.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. In a weird way, because I think organizations and groups, provide you an experience, and that experience, if you handle it correctly, that experience makes you grow into enlightenment. But when you think about what evolution is where you come up against an obstacle, you overcome that obstacle, And in overcoming that obstacle, you develop new powers, you develop new strengths, and you mutate. So, this may sound funny, but gaining enlightenment through a magical society or fraternal organization is done in spite of the organization instead of because of it.
Hmm.
Your experience is a growth experience. You evolve into enlightenment. Hmm. And an initiatory society, if it's well-crafted, well-organized, and well-executed, provides you a series of obstacles that you overcome until you've mutated yourself into an enlightened being.
Hmm.
Of course, that's just my way of looking at things.
Sure, sure. That's very, very interesting hearing about that. And I mean, what would you say if we go back to the OTO a little bit? And I mean, this has been targeted, as I read in the introduction to the first segment. This has been considered to be one of the more controversial magical or secret orders. Would you? Many people have argued then that the OTO is behind a lot of the evil things in the world, and even because of their adaptation, I guess, of the Thelema, that this is. It's only to make yourself. It's a kind of an ego-driven thing, I guess, with the idea of do what thou wilt, that shall be the whole of the law. This has been very much interpreted that way by many people, and many Christians, by many people who aren't into that, so to speak. What would you say to that or against that, I guess?
Oh, as an organization, we don't rule the world. We have a hard time, getting through a yearly meeting perhaps on some wide magical non-corporeal, plane of existence. The OTO is an influential, body as far as the evolution of the planet goes. I personally think Thelema is the movement that embodies the magical formula of the age, but I think that's a far greater concept than any one single organization can encapsulate or embody. The OTO, when Crowley died, there were only a handful of OTO members that still considered themselves OTO members left.
Hmm.
And Crowley wanted to see the OTO primarily be this outer organization that is semi-public, just like similar to the Masons.
Hmm.
And he wanted the OTO to be the real brick and mortar organization that helps perpetuate and advance the cause of Thelema through the publishing of Crowley's material and the preservation and keeping Crowley's work and writings before the public.
Mm-hmm.
And to provide the personal initiatory experience of going through, about 20 very well crafted, and remarkable, degree experiences. And when Crowley died, the OTO, was inherited by a man named Carl Germer.
Mm-hmm.
And Crowley, wrote various, letters to various people saying how he would like to see the order develop and who he would like to see be Carl's heir and things like that. And when Carl died, Major Grady McMurtry, who was a surviving ninth degree member of the OTO, and who had certain letters of authorization from Crowley,
mm-hmm.
to take over the order in the case of an emergency. Letters that mention the successorship from Karl Germer, particularly. He put out feelers to the various living members still alive and made the decision that if he didn't exercise that power of authority, then the OTO as a organization on the physical plane would die with the deaths of the last few remaining members. He activated those letters of authorization and started initiating again. Karl Germer stopped initiating during the period between Crowley's death and when Grady McMurtry took over. I am personally satisfied with the Grady's letters of authorization. Not only that, I'm perfectly satisfied that according to the a very in-your-face statement in the Book of the Law that success is your proof. I've seen there were five people in the order when I took initiation in 1975, and now there are over 3,000. Mm-hmm. It makes it the largest magical order in the world. 3,000 is not much, but it makes it the biggest magical organization in the world. It has recreated and established Crowley's degree initiation program in a way that was never instituted even in Crowley's day. It is totally consistent with the founding documents of the order from even the time before Crowley took over the organization. So I have an unambiguous support for the OTO as manifested as from Grady McMurtry and his successor. When people say that the OTO split up or there's many OTOs, in my opinion, that is incorrect. Really? And that has been held up in courts of law as well as in just the way the order has manifested. So that's, I don't have to say that just because I'm, an international officer. Mm-hmm. And I think any way of seeing this in objective reality that's any different than that is severely flawed and probably motivated by other motives than just whether a person thinks that a international organization is the right one or not.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting to hear about this. And before we begin to round things up here a little bit for this time, Lon, I also want to pop another question by you in regards to, let's say, criticism about Freemasonry. When, if what your take on that is, so to speak, when, if you understand, I guess, the criticism of Freemasonry, if we look at a lot of the elite members that are joined in Masonry as well, if we take one of the most, I guess, obvious example, Prince Edward, right, the Duke of Kent, the first cousin of Queen Elizabeth II, that he's the Grand Master of the United Lodge in England, and a lot of people are obviously connecting royalty and very much rich people with Freemasonry. And from my point of view, I definitely understand that is a concern, especially then when it is a secret society. What's your take on that, and what would you say to that?
Well, knowing what goes on in a Masonic lodge, I wouldn't be too concerned about anything draconian developing in Masonry itself. Mm-hmm. No matter who claims to be a Mason. The way it developed in the United Kingdom was that what began as a very working class organization had such developed such a nobility of character that eventually it became attractive for members of the royalty to also align themselves with that in an almost statement of egalitarianism, enough to say that here I am, you know, a prince or a king, and within the tiled temple of a Masonic lodge, I am the brother, the equal to the bricklayer or the chimney sweep, mm-hmm. or the janitor. Mm-hmm. And so from that point of view, it was, you know, it showed a certain amount of magnanimous desire to be a Mason among royalty. And of course, you know, as people are people and things develop in such a way as to, well, now the snobs are in control. Right. Well, the snobs aren't in control of my lodge or my California Grand Lodge or Masonry worldwide. And if there is any kind of a conspiracy, if there is something draconian going on, it's not because of the person's involvement in Masonry or the secrecy that they enjoy within the tiled Masonic lodge. It is because the person is a Mason and is also a scoundrel. Mm. And so we could say, look, there's a big milk conspiracy because the 100% of the munitions manufacturers in the world, the people that make a hideous profit out of starting wars and perpetuating wars, these personifications of evil, all of them drank milk as children. Some of them continue to drink milk. So I'm sorry, is it a milk drinker's conspiracy? Hmm. Okay, milk has very little to do with it. It's just a common thing. And anybody that, at least in the last 50 years, who wanted to get ahead in politics, who wanted to get ahead in community service, who wanted to get ahead in their military careers, it was just one other thing that they did to rub elbows with other people who could advance their careers, and that was to join the Masons.
Right.
So. Hmm. So blaming the Masons, in my opinion, is just as misguided as blaming milk.
Right, right. Well, very interesting hearing from your perspective, Lon, and hearing about everything from Motio to Crowley to Freemasonry and everything that we've been talking about today. Why don't we wrap things up here for this time, talking a little bit about your website. Please go ahead and mention that again for people, and we can also just say that I guess your new and latest book is called Enochian Vision Magic, which goes into a little bit of this that we began talking in this segment about in regards to John Dee, Edward Kelly, and Enochian Magic. So, Lon, if you will, please go ahead and mention your website again for us.
Okay, it's www.lonmiloduquette, all one word, that's LonMiloDuquette.com.
Brilliant. And again, I want to mention the great work as well. We didn't get time to talk so much about that here today, but again, that is something that people can check out. Head on over to their website. If you're interested, you can check out some of the trailers and so forth there. You can find it either at magicalegypt.com or I guess do a search for the website actually is thegreatnetwork.com, I think, if I have that correct. But again, these...
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Thegreatnetwork.com. And I will have these links up on redaskcreations.com as well, so people who are listening can find them easily from our website and click through from there. But beyond that, then, thank you very much today, Lon, for your time. It has been Very interesting hearing from you, hearing from your perspective, and thank you for your time and sharing some of this with us here today.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'd just like to add that the great work is like an initiatory experience in a DVD series, and it's got some of the coolest people on the planet that's part of it, and I really urge anybody interested in initiation and initiation in kind of the new age to experience the great work.
Absolutely, and again, there's other people interviewed in the series as well, like John Anthony West, Georgia Lambert, John Michael Greer, Art Rosengarten, Pamela J. Smith, and a few others as well. But definitely head on over to their website and check that out. Again, thank you very much for coming on, Lon, for your time. And,
thank you for having me. Sorry I ran off at the mouth.
No, definitely not. We like to hear from our guest's perspective. And so again, thank you very much.
Okay.
That concludes our program with Lon Milo Duquette. Thank you very much for listening. Keep an eye on redicecreations.com for more upcoming radio webcasts and, of course, follow along in our news. My thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. Take good care, and we'll talk more soon.